Hal Johnson has a bachelor in science in experimental psychology from Montana State University, then moved to Tallahassee for graduate school in neuroanatomy. He worked for the Florida Department of Children and Families, where he coordinated the psychotropic drug program, and then worked in the private sector until 2001, when he went to work for the Florida Substance Abuse and Mental Health Program Office. He coordinated the Youth Substance Abuse Survey and served as the program epidemiologist until 2013. He earned his master's in public health in 2007, and he left the Substance Abuse Office in 2013 to start his own consulting business, Hal Johnson Consulting. Please welcome Hal.
Good morning. Thanks for coming on the last day. I really didn't figure there'd be more than 8 people here, so this is great. Okay, in the late part of the first decade of this century, Florida's pill mills became legendary. People, you know, from the Appalachia were coming down to get their pills and all of that, and the storefronts were popping up in little strip malls all over, and you can see how packed the waiting rooms were and lines outside. And if anybody took a vacation during that time in Florida, you probably saw that billboard down on the left. They were all over the place on I-95 and I-75 heading down toward Fort Lauderdale and Miami. There were advertisements in the yellow pages and mobile billboards on trucks. It was a pretty interesting thing to see. And then finally the legislature started trying to act on it. And actually there's one senator, Mike Pisano from Pasco County, just above Tampa, Pinellas County, no, Pasco, just above Tampa, really, really worked to try to get a PDMP in Florida from about 2000, 2001, and got nowhere. Finally, in 2009, they passed the legislation, but they didn't fund it. They created a foundation to fundraise, and eventually they started it with the federal grant that was available, but it wasn't fully funded until 2011, I don't think, and even then they still have the foundation trying to get more money. But following that in 2010, the pain clinics were finally regulated, and Operation Pill Nation was established, and that was a joint task force with the DEA, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and local investigators. Initially, they conducted joint investigations to determine where the rogue pill mills were. And then in 2011, as a continuation of Operation Pill Mill, they had massive raids and made, and a single day, 2 days, hundreds of arrests, impounded like I can't remember the exact figure, but millions of dollars worth of merchandise, including a Jaguar. Really cracked down. And then that same year in 2011, the legislature prohibited pill mills from prescribing drugs that they dispensed. So, mandatory PDMP reporting began in September or October of 2011. In 2012, wholesale distributors of drugs regulations were strengthened substantially. And after 2011, the signs changed. That one billboard in Pinellas County were shutting down pill mills, I think is pretty cool. And then a doctor shopping billboard. Okay, so Florida's actions against pill mills was successful. This article, actually Mike Landon quoted that same article. I authored that one, that MMWR, with Len Palazzi and a couple of other folks, documenting the actions we took in a little bit more detail than I just said, and the results. Oxycodone deaths decreased dramatically between the peak in 2010 and 2014. But I wanted to look at what trends from the other opioids looks like over that same time period. So I used the Florida Medical Examiner Commission data. That includes 44 specific drug categories including 12 opioids. And it reports on whether each, the medical examiners in each region report on whether each substance was, they considered it a cause of death or it was merely present. And for most of my analyses until towards the end, you'll see, I look only at deaths that are caused by substances I'm looking at. I don't deal with ones that are merely present. And these are the opioid categories that they look at: fentanyl, heroin, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, meperidine, methadone, morphine, oxycodone, tramadol, and beginning in 2009, oxymorphone and buprenorphine. And until 2010, there was a catch-all other categories, other opioids category. It got very little use except for codeine, so they dropped that and just added codeine beginning in 2010. And what I find, you can see here the oxycodone. This is 26 to 2010 during the surge in use. Oxycodone largely drove it. 2.73 deaths per 100,000 in 2006, up to 8.06 in 2010. And everything else was relatively flat. But if we blow it up and look at the small rate groups. You see heroin dropped from 2008 to 2010 from 0.64 to 0.26 per 100,000. And oxymorphone, which started in 2009, like I said, went from 0.31 deaths to 0.7. And tramadol and hydromorphone also rose slightly, but not really meaningfully. Okay, so the rate of death caused by opiates other than oxycodone, oxymorphone, and heroin were relatively stable between 2006 and 2010. The range for methadone was 3.7 to 4.25. Hydrocodone range was 1.3 to 1.7. Morphine, 1.3 to 1.6. And nothing else exceeded 0.65 per 100,000 deaths. But the oxycodone death rate nearly tripled. And oxymorphone death rates more than doubled in 1 year, and heroin rate dropped by 60% in those 2 years. Okay, so this is the overall picture of any opioid that's caused by any opioid. That first rise to 2010, obviously, I just discussed is due to oxycodone, but I wanted to look at what the drop after 2010 and then the reversal again in 2013 is all about. So here's the trends for all of the drugs from all of the opioids from 2010 to 2014. And you can see oxycodone turned around and dropped from 8.06 to even lower than it was in 2006, down to 2.41 deaths per 100,000. But everything else is kind of a spaghetti mix here, so I broke it out. These are the lower rate of substances here. That hydrocodone is down 1.68 to 1.28, not dramatically, but it's down. Oxymorphone is down, and hydromorphone and tramadol both went up somewhat. And these are the higher use substances. As I said, oxycodone went down dramatically, but morphine went up from 1.39 to 3.61 deaths, and heroin from 0.26 to 2.9 went up, and fentanyl from 1.6 to 2.09 went up. So what we have for the recent data is 6 of the 12 opioids were causal in less than one death per 100,000 population across all years from 2010 to 2014. There was a small increase in hydromorphone and tramadol deaths that was generally offset by the decrease in oxymorphone deaths. The rate of deaths attributable to hydrocodone decreased by about 23%, and deaths attributed to methadone also contributed to the overall decline, dropping 56%. As the increase seen in the last decade, the largest contributor to the reduction in the overall opioid death rate is oxycodone. It was reduced 70% since 2010. But and the increase in the overall death rate from 2013 to 2014 is due almost entirely to those three opioids, fentanyl, morphine, and heroin. The morphine death rate increased 159%, fentanyl 236%, and heroin increased 719% in those 4 years. So we can fill this table in, or this graph in again, where the oxycodone was the cause for the increase. Oxycodone, methadone, and hydrocodone were responsible for the decline we saw, and then morphine, fentanyl, and heroin are responsible for the turnaround and beginning to increase again. So if we look at the new epidemic, there's a significant portion of the morphine deaths are likely due to heroin, which metabolizes very quickly into morphine and 6-MEM. That's, what is it?
6-monoacetylmorphine.
Acetyl, that's what it is. 6-monoacetylmorphine, okay. And that's a telltale. If that's found in a decedent, he died of heroin. But a lot of the medical districts have historically either not checked for 6-MEM or were not able to. Their labs are not equipped to check for it. And fentanyl has recently been found as a heroin adulterant. So I guess my premise going into this study was that, for the most part, heroin was responsible for the fentanyl and the morphine, too. So I looked at this just blew my mind when I actually did this graph and saw the result. In 2006, 80% of heroin-caused deaths, were heroin only. By 2014, 80% were heroin and something else that was deemed to be causal. So I thought, I've got to figure out what those other drugs are. So, heroin-caused death. Now, this particular graph includes heroin-caused deaths with other opioids that were either causal or just present. I wanted to get a more broad look on this one. And as expected, morphine and fentanyl were in there, but codeine popped up, and I thought, what? That just came out of nowhere in my mind. So I wanted to look at it. Then I broke it out then by cause versus only present. And codeine is very unique. Morphine and fentanyl, for the most part, if they were in a heroin-caused death, they were deemed to be causal also. Codeine was only present. For most of the cases of codeine were only present in heroin-caused death. And I started digging into that and realized that the most likely scenario is that codeine has a morphine milligram equivalency of only 0.15. So it's a very weak opioid. And my guess is that most of the medical examiners see it there, and if the subject died of a heroin overdose, the codeine didn't cause anything. So that's my guess. I don't know, but I won't deal anymore with codeine in the rest of this one. Okay, this is an astounding number to me. You see that blue line is the death was caused by heroin and morphine, so it was clearly heroin. That increased by 5,500% from 2010 to 2014, from 5 deaths to 279. The red line on the bottom is where morphine was present but not determined to be a cause. That probably is just at the discrepancy of the medical examiner. It was heroin and morphine was present. And that increased by 64% from 5 to 37. Excuse me. But the one where heroin was the cause and morphine was absent increased 142%, but that doesn't make any sense to me, and I'm not quite sure why, because morphine should always be there in a heroin death. I don't know. If anybody's got an answer for that, I'd love that during the question and answer period. And then I switched just turned it over, looked at the mirror analysis. This is morphine-caused death by level of heroin causality. You see on the top, that is morphine death, but heroin was not recorded as being there. That rose 66%. I suspect that they're all heroin that had metabolized, and they didn't detect any heroin, and they didn't have any physical evidence that they could say it was heroin, but they detected the morphine, so that they were conservatively rooted as morphine. Again, there's the same line that I showed before where morphine and heroin were both called cause, and that increased 5,500. The bottom line is almost noise. Where morphine was the cause and heroin was present but not the cause, it ranges from 1 to 0 in each of those years, so that's a non-factor. I looked at this number of deaths caused by heroin and morphine by mutually exclusive categories. So the green is morphine caused the death and heroin was either present or absent. The red is heroin caused it and morphine was either present or absent. And the blue is heroin and morphine were both considered causal. And as you can see, the blue, the heroin and morphine causal clearly grew the most. And if we take that same graph and put it on 100% stack bar, you can see the actual percent of where heroin was causal and morphine was causal and heroin was either present or absent is decreasing, has decreased from 85% down to 51%. Whereas the percent that both heroin and morphine were causes of death have increased from 2 to 33% over that time period. If all of the now we're getting to the fun part. If all of the morphine deaths are actually heroin, these lines would be combined, and the actual number from heroin would double. So instead of reporting the 408 conservatively that we report now, I would say it's much closer to 834 a year in 2014. And, I am right at the end. Okay, this is deaths caused by heroin, the conservative measure of heroin, just the heroin, and fentanyl. And you see on the left where the heroin is the cause of death and fentanyl is the cause of death. So it's the leftmost graph on both sides. We're 14 in 2013 and 88 in 2014. And so that increased pretty dramatically. And then on the right, on both sides, on the left side, the third bar, where heroin causal and fentanyl was absent, increased. But on the right side, that was kind of surprising to me, where fentanyl was a cause of death and heroin was absent, was not as great. I would have expected it to be causal with the heroin if it was laced with the heroin. So this was a surprise. I thought, well, I wonder if I combine and look at the less conservative look and include the morphine with the heroin in my definition of heroin, what would happen? And so I did that, and the pattern is basically the same. The numbers are different, but the pattern is basically the same. So the next logical step was to look at the portion of fentanyl-caused deaths with heroin or heroin and morphine, causal or present, versus absent. You see that the percentage of fentanyl that didn't include fentanyl deaths that did not include heroin or morphine at all decreased some, indicating that there is more lacing of heroin with it, but it's still two-thirds of it almost is just pure fentanyl. And that really surprised me because of the talk of heroin laced with fentanyl. I have heard talk of fentanyl pills and that sort of thing out there, like masqueraded as Xanax, and that may be more common in Florida than I had any idea of, so we'll have to look farther into that. So in conclusion, the increase seen in deaths caused by morphine overdose is likely largely due to metabolized heroin. If these deaths are all considered heroin deaths, then the heroin death rate doubles. And fentanyl adulterated heroin is a problem in Florida, as has been reported elsewhere, with a large increase between 2013 and 2014. But two-thirds of the fentanyl caused death in 2014 did not involve heroin. And this is a conclusion slide, and I've got a strange button on there, but I'm leaving this afternoon and have five free rides left, or five paid-for rides left on a bus pass if anybody can use it. I had to put it on here. I knew I'd forget to say that. But that's it.
Questions? Good, I see two questions. The long walk up to the microphone.
I have a question. So in terms of, can you go back and explain a little bit more about the causal present and absent? And do you know how that was determined ultimately in your study?
Yeah, it's determined by the medical examiner, from the medical examiner's data. And when they fill out their medical examiner data stuff, there's a form that they have to fill out, and they have to determine, go down each of those 44 drugs and say if it was present. They say it's either absent, it's not there, or it's there,
so you don't
but it's
the quantitative testing results, right?
No, I don't get any of that.
Okay.
Hey.
So I just wanted to let you know from experience in Washington State, we often find codeine as a metabolite that exists when it is in heroin death. So
really?
That may be why it's popping up there. Sort of,
oh, that's interesting. I looked at it, and I know codeine also metabolizes into morphine, but I didn't realize that it went from heroin through codeine to morphine.
I'm not sure exactly how that happens biochemically, but we often see it.
Okay.
And then my other question was about whether you have access to the literal text, because often what we see is when it is a heroin overdose that the medical examiners or coroners will also write morphine, and they'll write in parentheses heroin. So I was just wondering if you had the ability to look at that or not.
No, I just get a common delimited data file from them every year.
Yeah, okay. And then one thing we have been encouraging is that for those cases where they aren't able to detect a fixed MAM, if they see paraphernalia or whatever else indicative of heroin, we have been suggesting to them that they write a probable heroin overdose.
Right. Ours definitely take that into consideration. That's why I mentioned something about physical. If they have no physical evidence and the tox doesn't come back with heroin, then they do that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Hi there. My name is Jamie. I'm from Boulder County.
Hi.
And thanks for both presenters, actually. Thank you so much for your detailed analysis. And I have a question, actually, about who the main audience is for these reports and how it's used. So whether it's law enforcement, healthcare providers, pharmacists, and then if there's any interventions that have resulted as a result of your analysis, for instance, with harm reduction organizations, naloxone, or law enforcement. Thank you.
The target of my presentation or of okay, well, I got it from the Medical Examiners Commission, and they're mandated by the legislature to create a report every year, and I just get the raw data from them that they use to create that report, and it's posted online. Honestly, I think the main audience for it is, well, they have to do it because the legislature said they do. I'm not sure how many people use it, to be perfectly honest with you. I think there's about a handful of substance abuse epidemiologists in Florida that use it, and that's probably it. But I present it to a lot of people, and I presented a lot of coalitions, and so local coalitions have used it to a pretty large degree. I don't know when
for the analysis of this stuff, part of this is, and it hasn't happened yet because I got this analysis done in a big rush before the meeting and a rush of other business. But the point of this stuff is to push it out, to try and educate the prescribers. We have a governor's advisory committee on pain management. I'll say so. pain management, overdose prevention, drug misuse. I call it the council with the really long name, and it keeps me from remembering the really long name. But part of it is to push some of this that trying to move the narrative and get the prescribers to realize that their patients are at risk and they're not clear who, which ones are. So, and I'm on the agenda for the audit right after, you know, early July. I'm on the agenda for, I think, the osteopathic board. They're one of the big three opioid prescribing boards. And later Santa Fe County coalition. So I'm going to push some of these things on those groups and try and push the narrative that way. And part of it is just, you know, as you start to get the understanding, then you can start, you know, trying to change the perception, which is really the point.
Alan Eckerson, and you talked about Raquel. You know, so I'm pretty old, so I trained years ago in medicine, and it really is remarkable for me the cultural change that has occurred in prescribing patterns. And so part of it, I think, has to do with how providers now are rated in these, like, health ratings, like your health grade and whatever. And so if the provider doesn't provide good pain relief, then they get lower ratings, things like this. So the culture change that has occurred is really a problem. I mean, it's both, you know, the providers are under a lot of pressure to give proper pain relief. You know, the fifth vital sign is now the thing. And so I kind of wondered, what is the direction that we're going in to try to develop prevention with these providers when you're up against a really big problem. I mean, it's, you know, you're just doing, showing them the data that it's caused a problem isn't enough, you know.
Yeah, well, and there are a number of surveys that I've seen that providers are worried about this, but that on the other hand, there's some data that suggests that it doesn't actually change, that those rankings don't actually do anything much. So it's hard to say. Part of it is, I worked in traffic safety and DWI for many, many years. And DWI is not a question of enforcement. It is a question of social change. And you can use enforcement as a tool for social change. Drug overdose death is going to be a social change problem. And one of the things that means is that there is lots more job security than I or even some of my much younger colleagues are going to need. We're going to be at this a while because it is a social change thing. The pain is a fifth vital sign. Was driven by a number of factors, but, you know, in politics, the things that look like grassroots organizations but are actually corporately funded are known as AstroTurf. And there was a lot of AstroTurf in the pain is a fifth vital sign, and it's going to take us a while to unwind that, but a lot of that was supported by the drug companies through their marketing budgets. So we're going to have to unwind that, and we've got to unwind the way patients and prescribers look at pain and pain relief and, you know, what the expectations are and what is reasonable. I think also that people got convinced that the opioids are much less dangerous than they actually are. And we're going to have to unwind that too. There is a picture, I think, in the prescribing community that these are basically benign. And they're okay in short term. There are absolutely no studies that show that they're effective in the long term. There are no studies longer than 12 or 16 weeks. So we're, you know, people have rolled the dice on this and we have a crisis. And it's going to take us a while to unwind it, I think.
I wanted to comment one because Jim Davis has, for the CSTE overdose subcommittee, has talked about how important it is that we come up with good measures of pain at the population level. As epidemiologists, that's part of the missing puzzle for us when we look at some of this data. I think that I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I think it's not just a discussion with providers, right? I can't think of our colleague right now in Arizona who, when she speaks about this topic, she says we need to think about changing how we as a society view pain and how we view pain management. And so part of that is not seeking a pharmacological approach for pain management, but really supporting non-pharmacological approaches, and that includes increasing the research and evidence base for the types of interventions that are non-pharmacological. So I really appreciate you bringing up that, and if you have ideas about how CSTE can help with that conversation and that social shift, I think we all would love to hear that.
Just to follow on that, quick shout out to Naomi Green, who's CSTE SAMHSA fellow in substance abuse in New Mexico, who's been working on, has worked to develop a proposed purpose module for on chronic pain, which we're proposing this year into the BRFSS, which if we're lucky, we might get the survey in the field in 2017, and in a couple of years, we might know a little more than we do.
My name is Ms. Fallon. I'm up here from the Alabama Department of Public Health. And my question relates to any opportunities to explore crossover into maternal health for pregnant women who may have been a victim of an opioid overdose, and if there's any data that actually examines those situations where you may have a pregnant woman who may have succumbed to some of these overdoses. And I'll take that last round, by the way.
Okay. We have a winner.
My family here, so I'm going to catch up with them. Thank you.
Five rides left.
So a couple of things. There has been some work done. We're doing some work. A number of folks have been doing some work on neonatal abstinence syndrome, which would be a marker for opioid use in pregnant women. There are other things. Benzos also are implicated in that. In terms of the data, I haven't known. I mean, there is an indicator in the medical exam data about pregnancy, and I haven't looked, so I'll need to do that.
I'm not aware of anything important.
Yeah, and Barbara wrote down a question about how Native Americans in New Mexico legally get opioids, and whether it's through IHS, Indian Health Service, and yes, indeed, it is. At least in recent times, the last couple of years, I do see reporting from many of the IHS facilities in the PMP. So, but it's phased in. So in this period, that may be a shortfall.
Right.
The classification of diversion in the Native American population may be overstated. These data things, I hadn't thought of that.
So it's 1:26. We can stay for four minutes, or you can come up and talk and everyone else can go. But I want to thank you all. I want to thank the presenters. I think there's some ideas here that we could replicate in our own jurisdiction, as well as improve upon some of the analyses if we have richer data sources. So thank you all for coming.